Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. During the past month and a half, as we've discussed on this podcast, public opinion has moved significantly in favor of the Black Lives Matter movement, and more people have taken on the view that Black people face discrimination in America. That also comes at a time when white liberals were already increasingly telling pollsters that they're concerned about racial inequality and discrimination. But it's one thing to tell a pollster that, and it's perhaps another thing to support the policies that try to rectify the inequalities you see. So will Democrats, particularly white Democrats, support policies like greater school integration, affirmative action, or reparations? My colleagues Perry Bacon Jr. and Meredith Conroy dug into the data to try to figure out the answer to that question. And they're here with me to discuss what they found. So Perry, it's good to have you. Welcome.
Thanks, Galen.
And Meredith is a political science professor at California State University and is also a 538 contributor. Welcome to the show, Meredith. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to get into the details plenty, but let's talk about the general trend here before we dive in. Is there support for specific policies to address racial inequality amongst Democrats broadly, white Democrats in particular?
I'd say that there is increasingly this strong foundation for support for the specific policies that would address racial inequality, just given especially white Democrats' attitude changes about discrimination and racism, because prejudice undermines support for the policies that we're talking about. So if people are less prejudiced, they'll be more open to the policies that benefit Black Americans in particular. Whether the specific policy proposals that are overtly race conscious have the support of white Democrats, I think that's less clear from the data that we looked at.
So just to tell a little bit of background about how the story came about, I think this came from some of our colleagues. It was one of these meetings in the midst of the George Floyd protests in which people said white Democrats are at all these protests. So is this kind of fake wokeness or is this something real? And I was like, well, I don't totally know. And so my thought was, let's try to look at a bunch of a wide range of issues. So we probably spent a week, the two of us, just looking for polling. That was not the most fun week of my life. We just sort of looked for poll after poll. And honestly, we need some more polls about things beyond policing and Confederate monuments. And I quickly found there wasn't a whole lot to see on some issues. And I was sort of trapped in looking at polls in 2018. But the general idea is to sort of figure out, okay, saying that you think Black Lives Matter is probably important, a sign of something, but what does that look like? You know, we sort of know that schools in New York and San Francisco are very segregated, even though I'm guessing most people in those cities would say they think Black Lives Matter and they think school integration is important.
You focused in this polling particularly on Democrats, but if we were to step back for a second, what do we know about the Republican side of the equation? I mean, is there just no support at all? Is there some support before we delve deeply into what divides and what preferences exist in the Democratic Party?
Yeah, so we focused on Democrats because the gaps in these issues between Republicans and Democrats are enormous. And they're also like written about all the time. And that's also a function of the way that polls are administered, you know, going back to more about why this was so complicated, especially like tracking polls, the sample sizes are smaller. So you can look at differences between Democrats and Republicans and reasonably generalize to those populations, but you can't do subsets because the samples are so small. So there's plenty, I would say, written about differences between Democrats and Republicans. And so we thought, let's dig into the interparty gaps, and in particular, white Democrats and Black Democrats, to assess, you know, whether they're on the same page about the issues regarding race and other topics that are in the news right now.
On pretty much every issue, Republicans were significantly less supportive of the policy than white Democrats. And in almost every issue, white Democrats and Black Democrats, while having a gap, they were closer to each other than white Democrats versus Republicans. We didn't end up, one more question about the method, we didn't end up writing about Hispanic or Asian Democrats, who are about 20% of Democrats. And I did think about that some, and we sort of talked about that some. The decision was basically that the issues we were trying to focus on were sort of issues related to racial inequality about Black people. So that was kind of one. And then the sort of the most Democrats are white. The group with the most money is white. if you're going to integrate schools, we're probably talking about white people ultimately. So that was kind of the thought. But we could have thought about including Asian and Latino Democrats' views on these issues. And also, there was some sample size limitation, so I couldn't even really summarize them, to be honest with you.
Yeah, your data collection is a story in and of itself here, which I think we can get a little more into as we go through some of this polling. But let's talk about what you actually found during that week of collecting polls. You looked at essentially four different categories. It was education, income, housing, and the workplace, all four areas where we see significant inequalities that's well documented in data. Then you looked at specific policies aimed at addressing those inequalities. And so let's begin with education here. A report last year from EdBuild showed that school districts that predominantly serve students of color receive $23 billion less in funding than mostly white school districts in 2016, despite serving the same number of students. So it's clear that there is an inequality there. What education policies are pollsters asking about that would try to address that? And what results did you see in this breakdown between white and black Democrats?
The big divide, and we heard about this a little bit last year during you know, when Kamala Harris and Joe Biden were at the debate, was that busing kids to other school districts as a way to integrate, 71% of black Democrats supported that. 49% of white Democrats supported that. And then sort of a related question, having students attend schools outside of their local areas in order to ensure diversity, 71% of black Democrats, 52% of white Democrats. So those are kind of echoes of the sort of busing of the most aggressive school integration. And my sense is we have a sort of an overlay from that in which black people sort of look upon Brown v. Board and that sort of busing period somewhat fondly. And that was very controversial among white people at the time and perhaps is right now. The big policy that was unpopular with both groups was considering race and ethnicity in college admissions, which only, according to this survey, at least from Pew, and I've seen others where it's more popular, but this survey, only 34% of white Democrats supported that, and only 39% of black Democrats supported that. And my guess is that as opposed to we're going to like look at each person and sort of evaluate race in terms of the admission, my guess as I'm talking to people is that a more popular idea might be to say, if you're in the top 10% of your class at school X, you get into college Y. My sense is people, both black and white, are somewhat nervous about race at the individual level. And we found that at the workplace diversity questions too, where people are also nervous about considering race in terms of who you get to hire at the individual level. So I think that was interesting finding. I was a little surprised, but I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, the affirmative action in college admission, like Perry said, not a lot of support. This is where, you know, some social science helps kind of inform what's going on here, possibly. When you think about, you know, the beneficiaries of policies and also the victims, I think that there's this discussion about affirmative action often, especially from the opponents, suggests that people who deserve to be admitted are being punished. And, you know, through this lens of equal opportunity, affirmative action, you know, doesn't seem to fit if you're emphasizing those core American values. And also goes to what Perry said about, you know, thinking about it at an individual level, you know, and we often think about college admissions in those ways. So I think that contributes to the low levels of support, you know, thinking about who's losing and who's winning here. And there's arguably clear losers, especially, you know, as opponents frame it. There's clear losers from affirmative action in college admissions, from people who don't deserve to lose. So you're losing a framing war there, probably. One policy would be redrawing school district lines, since school budgets rely primarily on property taxes. And I was surprised to see there was wide support amongst both white and black Democrats for redrawing school district lines. You know, more than 70% amongst both.
We should also be clear, and we didn't talk about this earlier, is that there's reason when you poll, particularly on racial issues, to be skeptical and to be very thoughtful about what the accuracy of response is in. And do people, like, I've lived in a few different communities. I don't think redrawing school district lines would actually be very popular in, let's say, Bethesda, Maryland, which, if you're trying to integrate into Washington, D.C. proper, or like Westchester, New York City. And I just think that issue might not actually be that popular if it was like politicized and really discussed. I don't think people really know what school district lines means in that way. And there might be a policy where they might sort of be vague about it. So I think it's worth thinking about. That one I jumped out at me as being, I don't believe that at all, and I'd like to see that happen in real life.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we can talk more about as we go through some of the different topics that you looked into, but when you look at the polling and when you look at what happens in real life, sometimes it's hard to marry the two things and make sense of it. So let's look ahead to some of the other areas that you looked into. The next one was income. And just to kind of set the scene here, the black and white wealth gap in the U.S. is as wide today as it was in the 60s, and it persists at every education level and is especially pronounced, actually, for people with bachelor's degrees and advanced degrees. So what kind of economic policies are pollsters asking about, Perry, when it comes to the income divide and wealth gap in America?
So the questions we focused on, and I think this is mostly what I found, was that we did a question about raising taxes on people who make more than $600,000 a year, or households, or more than $600,000 a year. There was a question about kind of a general wealth tax, the kind of thing Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders campaigned on. And then there were questions about reparations. And so what we found was, on the taxing the wealthy more or raising taxes on people with a lot of money, is that white Democrats were actually sort of more supportive than black Democrats, although both groups were overwhelmingly supportive. We're talking about in the 80s for both groups. And then on the reparations question, we saw some very large divides. Like, you know, like there was a lot of talk in the Democratic primary about how Joe Biden would win the black vote because black people are more moderate than white Democrats are. And I was always sort of skeptical about that. And it depends on what question you ask. But on reparations, we were seeing gaps in the 30s, where 70% of black Democrats support reparations, 30% of white people, white Democrats support reparations. So like a 40-point gap, a very, very large gap. And that was across surveys. That was surveys before George Floyd died. That was surveys after George Floyd died. So it tells me that, you know, obviously, it's not surprising that black Democrats may be more supportive of a policy in which they might get money than white Democrats. We should not ignore the obvious here. But that said, I think that was notable. I do want to note another thing, and this is like exclusive polling for the podcast that Meredith found, but I'm going to read it out. This is where I'm here now, is that Meredith looked at some Nationscape Democracy and Fund polling. And what she found was that black Democrats in all age groups generally support reparations. But Democrats under 45, when you look at white Democrats under 45, 46% support reparations, 30% oppose them, the rest not sure. So plus 16. Democrats who are white over 45, 21% support, 48% oppose. So plus 16 under 45, minus 27 over 45 among white Democrats. So a big, important age gap there.
Yeah, the data that we're talking about here is post Floyd's murder, so takes into account some of the shifts that we saw, which Perry mentioned, you know, before George Floyd's murder and after, the gaps are just as large. But I would say contributing to that, at least with the UCLA Nationscape data that we looked at, Democracy Fund, white Democrats and black Democrats are both moving.
So the gap remains the same, but it's because both groups are both more supportive of reparations in part. You know, it is important what you bring up here that a lot of this policy polling doesn't exist or isn't done very often. And so oftentimes you had to rely on polls that were conducted before George Floyd's murder. And we don't know whether or not the views on some of these things are changing, how quickly they're changing. And one thing that we should note here with regards to reparations is that Asheville, North Carolina, on Tuesday of this week, their city council approved reparations for black people in Asheville. And that is an 80% white community. I guess the question here is, was the city council doing that regardless of whether or not it was popular within the community? Or does this suggest that attitudes are actually changing?
it seems clear that it was motivated by how the conversation about racial inequality has shifted following George Floyd's death. I think a lot of the policy focus has been on policing. There's a clear connection there for people who are watching these videos. But the goal now for policymakers is to focus on systemic racism, and which reparations is about. And, you know, when listening to the reading the article where the city council explained their rationale, that's clear in how they're explaining the rationale. They're talking about the history of slavery in their community, in that community in particular, how that community benefited from slavery.
I've had a lot of discussions about reparations since this piece with our readers, who I presumably are mostly white, is my suspicion. Most people in America are white. It's not a surprise. You know. So I do think that part of what we're capturing here with these reparations polling is people don't really totally know what we're talking about. And I'll be honest with you, I don't really know exactly what. I think when we get more detailed proposals that actually have laws and are written up, I think the idea, people are not sure, does that mean like a poor white person is like having their taxes raised to give Oprah money? No, they're probably not for that. If it means Michael Bloomberg is getting his tax raised to give some black people, not Oprah, I think that might be a different way to think about it. So I think the reparations polling is helpful in that it tells us something. I think it tells us the idea is going to have to be moved a lot before it becomes very popular. But I don't think it tells us that much, because I think people are sort of reacting to this sort of general idea they don't totally understand. It may remain unpopular forever, but I do think it'd be worth thinking about this question as the sort of policy process goes through. Nicole Hannah-Jones wrote this New York Times Magazine piece that was really well read about reparations. I think there'll be other writings about this. And I think this is one issue where I'm curious where we are in 6 months.
Yeah, and I will note here that Asheville, North Carolina's reparations plan did not include cash payments, and it essentially was an agreement to put together a commission to look at what kinds of programs can be funded in order to reduce inequality. So even that may pull significantly differently than something that includes specific transfers of wealth from one group of people to directly to another. You know, as you mentioned, there's just a lot of polling that we don't have here, and more can and should be done for us to better understand what Americans want from all of this. Let's move on and talk about housing.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Ready to make the smartest choice for your business? Say hello to Shopify, the global commerce platform that makes selling a breeze. Whether you're starting your online shop, opening your first physical store, or hitting a million orders, Shopify is your growth partner. Sell everywhere with Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. Turn browsers into buyers with Shopify's best converting checkout, 36% better than other platforms. Effortlessly sell more with Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and supports global brands like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen? Join millions of successful entrepreneurs across 175 countries backed by Shopify's extensive support and help resources. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Start your success story today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. shopify.com/538.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
It's been more than 50 years since the Fair Housing Act passed, but many cities, this is no news to anybody, remain highly segregated with unequal distribution of resources and amenities across different cities. You know, in your piece, you even mentioned something as basic as supermarkets. What kind of appetite did you find amongst Black and white Democrats for promoting more affordable housing or maybe integrating people within cities?
On the poll questions that we found, Black and white Democrats were broadly similar, which is interesting, right? Because the same factors that shape your social policy attitudes on the other issues we've looked at, ideology, stereotype, prejudice, threat, guilt, which we'll talk about maybe a little bit more, they should shape support for these questions about housing. But yeah, the gaps were smaller here. However, I'll point out the questions weren't overtly race conscious. So they, you know, building more overall and building low income, those aren't overtly racial. So potentially that might explain why there was the same support for white and Black Democrats. Did you have thoughts on that, Perry? Again, we couldn't find questions that were explicitly about, as you mentioned, neighborhood integration. We looked as hard as we could, and hopefully my inbox doesn't fill up with people sending us, here's these questions about redlining or whatever. But yeah, the questions that we have here aren't overtly racialized.
So building more low-income housing in the suburbs, which I actually think is a pretty good question in that it has a racial, I don't think people are missing that one. So what you found was building more low-income housing in the suburbs, 79% of white Democrats supported that, 82% of Black Democrats did. Building more houses, condos, apartments in your community, 66% of white Democrats, 70% of Black Democrats. And then when they ask people who thinks their community is not racially diverse enough, so who thinks their community is too much of one race, 36% of white Democrats said that, 31% of Black Democrats said that. So on some level, we have deep housing segregation in the country. And if only a third of white and Black Democrats think it's a problem, that's an issue that suggests we're not going to solve that problem too quickly because they're not very invested in solving it. So the similarities in these responses, the questions were not necessarily, you know, did not actually say race in them. I do think that they had some sort of obvious racial implications. So I take the responses somewhat seriously. And it sort of told me, I think that, I mean, A, white Democrats may not at this point see housing integration in the same way they see like policing as a sort of immediate goal to make the world better for Black Americans. And then my guess is some Black Democrats want good neighborhoods, but they don't necessarily want to have more, having more white people in the neighborhood is not necessarily how they define a good neighborhood. They might define a neighborhood in terms of what comes into the neighborhood, what kind of stores there are, so on. So I think it's worth, I mean, Americans go to churches voluntarily, and they tend to go to churches that are of one race too. Both Black and white people do that. So I think the housing question may raise questions of like, what kind of demand do people actually have for integration when it's not framed in the school context?
Yeah, you know, this brings up the question when it comes to large percentages of both Black and white Democrats saying that they support more affordable housing being built in their community. You think of well-to-do white communities, oftentimes in liberal cities like San Francisco, for example, where you see a lot of opposition to building affordable housing, commonly referred to as NIMBYism or not in my backyard. So is this another place where we should question the polling versus the reality? And if so, why are people saying that this is something that they support, but then not supporting it in reality? Like, what would encourage somebody to tell a pollster that they support something that they don't actually?
People are trying to signal good things about themselves. And I'm not surprised people, when called on a poll, are like, let me keep the poor people away from me. I think that would be an unpopular thing to say. But in reality, I think the perception is that poor people commit more crimes. Maybe they're not as good, their kids are not as good at school. Maybe you just like a sort of more homogeneous community. In the school context, for example, we have a lot of evidence that white parents view a school as high performing in part based on test scores and in part because of the sort of whiteness of the school. And if the school has a lot of minorities in it, they tend to perceive the school is not as good, even if the data does not suggest that. So That question to me is obvious why there would be lying on that question. In fact, I was a little bit surprised more white Democrats did not lie and say they really wanted a racially diverse community, because that's my life experience, is lots of white Democrats say they want to live in diverse communities but don't. So I was surprised they didn't lie on that question too. But the overall, there's research on what's called social desirability. And that means that you sort of want to signal to yourself right now, if you're a Democrat of any race, particularly if you're a white Democrat, the way the culture is shifted on racial issues means that you're often sort of pressured to signal certain things. And I think that's kind of what the danger of all this polling is, that you might want to signal things you don't quite believe yet.
Yeah. And when, you know, when you're forming opinions about policies, especially maybe ones that you haven't thought about deeply, you're going to rely on, you know, what psychologists refer to as heuristic shortcuts. And so if you're, as Perry mentioned, that the Democratic Party in particular is moving left on a lot of these kinds of issues. And so you probably do, I would say, possess those values, you know, about addressing racial inequality. And then you hear a question like this and you're like, yes, this would address racial inequality. I agree. But yeah, I think it's different than actually when it, you know, that's what NIMBYism is. Then, okay, now it's in your backyard. What do you say now? And so, you know, I do think the values are there and do reflect what people believe, but they probably feel different when it comes to their own communities.
And just to take it a step further, why don't white Democrats support this when it comes to their own community?
I mean, the short answer is, like, race and income and power and class are very related in our country. So it's not surprising to me if, like, I mean, it's hard to sort of prove this, but my guess is if for a lot of people who are white, if they could have a community, they could have a neighborhood in which Barack Obama lives there, the guy who directed Hamilton lives there, Susan Rice lives there, Kamala Harris lives there, and then most of the rest of the community is white, that might be what they're looking for. There's nothing wrong with that, because that would have a community that would have a lot of cultural power, a lot of economic power, a lot of wealth, and also be diverse too. It's like, you know, I went to Yale. It has a very high number of rich people that attend Yale, but there's benefits to going to Yale. I'm not personally rich, but there's a lot of benefits to going to Yale. So I think it'd be hard for me, the way our country is structured, it'd be hard for me to tell someone who's upper income, don't live in a fancy neighborhood that has great schools and has a lot of resources in it. Part of the sort of the one of the challenges of this kind of article is we're talking about sort of problems at the individual level, but in reality, the solutions probably need to be at the societal level. Like, if everybody's invested in school integration, then everybody's sort of taking the benefits and the cost of that, versus if we're not all invested in it, then maybe nobody should be. And I think it's where we are now, is like, there can be a lot of hoarding because, you know, often more integrated environments are more challenging in certain ways. Like, there are benefits of integration in terms of, like, you learn from other people, you benefit from them. There are challenges in terms of people's differences can be apparent and can be challenging.
Yeah, I think that's an important perspective. And as we're learning here in this conversation, polling can't tell us everything. Maybe you didn't want to hear that on the 538 Politics podcast, but, like,
right,
polling can tell us a lot of things, like what people say they believe when they're asked about it. But even when it's a genuinely held belief, it can't necessarily tell us why. And that's where a lot of research comes in, and reading and conversation. And so, yeah, I'll just put that out there. Sorry, folks, polls can't tell us absolutely everything. So finally, we've talked about education, we've talked about income and housing. Finally, you looked at workplaces, and Black Americans face notably higher levels of unemployment and underemployment, even among college grads. So what did you find about appetites amongst white Democrats for integrating workplaces, considering race and hiring and things like that?
All of these polls were conducted in 2019 or 2018, the polls that we found on workplace diversity. There were a lot of similarities between white and Black Democrats on these questions. And with race should be considering in hiring and promotion, only 37% of white Democrats agreed that it should be considered, and only 38% of Black Democrats. So low support amongst both groups. Broadly, though, affirmative action, 79% of white Democrats and 78% of Black Democrats are in favor of affirmative action, which, you know, Perry and I have discussed, is that's pretty vague. And then whether or not companies should promote racial diversity, huge support. 89% of white Democrats said companies should support racial diversity, and 82% of black Democrats. That's one of those softer, I would say, questions, you know, promoting racial diversity. What does that really mean? But yeah, really similar on the questions that we looked at.
These responses actually made a lot of sense to me. Every workplace I've worked at, including 530, I would probably say has this same dynamic, which is that I think a lot of people want to work in a diverse workplace. They don't necessarily want to have job X. We posted, we want to have a black person in this job, or we want to have a woman or a Latino person in this job. So I think that actually is a real core tension, which is that we all want to have diverse workplaces in a lot of ways. We're not really sure how to get there. And if that means each hire is going to be evaluated on a race and gender dynamic, people don't really like that. And that's not surprising to me. So I think this is kind of one of those places where I think the intentions and the kind of how to execute the intentions are a big gap, and it's a hard one to resolve.
I think the conversation is might be moving a little bit on this. I've been paying a little bit of attention to, for example, the latest Vanity Fair cover was shot for the first time ever by a black photographer of Viola Davis. And I feel like that kind of thing is being celebrated. And in fact, people are being, rightly critical of Vanity Fair for taking this long to have a black photographer. So in many ways, I do think this potentially could be changing, thinking about race in jobs.
Yeah, and I mean, to some extent in this issue, it's potentially an area where broad public opinion matters less, because private companies can, within the bounds of workplace discrimination law, create their own policies and pursue what they want to pursue, whether or not 75% of Americans agree with them or something like that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think on the Monday podcast, I listened to that episode. I think, Perry, you brought up how at the elite level changes are being made, and you were talking about corporations and various company policies. And, you know, as a political scientist, I was like, oh, yeah, not everything has to happen through legislation. Like, real change can happen in other areas. And so, yeah, that's a good point, Galen.
I'm curious, talking about all of these different topics, housing, education, income, workplace, did you find particular trends in where white and black Democrats were largely in agreement and where there was a significant divide?
I think the way we framed it was when the solution was sort of race specific, meaning like mainly reparations, but also when the solution was very, let's say, broad-based, intrusive, aggressive, pick a word here. Those are the ones where it was unpopular and there was a gap. Like, I would say sort of ideas like reparations, busing, change, you know, sending students to schools outside of local communities. Those were the sort of most aggressive ideas in which sort of, I would argue, most of the benefits might come to black people and not much to white people. So unsurprisingly, those were the ones where the biggest gap was. And in terms of the ones where it was most similar, where I would say is the opposite of that, is like like magnet schools, or like things that are sort of more vague, and companies should promote more racial diversity. It's not surprising that is like very popular. That was in the 80s. So I think that's the general trend. But I would be reluctant to say too much more about this, because I don't think we have a lot more questions.
Yeah, you mentioned throughout the piece, as we've mentioned already, that there are certain places where people may overstate their support for a specific policy because they want to appear accepting, and they know from their political social interactions that that's the quote-unquote right answer. Is there any more optimistic view that some of this polling, because it was conducted before this reckoning, is understating where people are currently?
Okay, so I think a couple things are possible in which we might understate it. One is that, and I was hinting at this earlier, is that the conversations themselves that we're having right now may pretend to changes in 6 months or 9 months or 2 years. Like the conversation around reparations, like the University of California says they want to consider race in admissions again. So are there things where there's sort of elite signaling from a big university, from the New York Times Magazine, from Ibram Kendi, from Robin DiAngelo. People are reading these books. So are people's views going to change based on that? It's hard for me to imagine that they wouldn't change, because you're already seeing that. Like, Black Lives Matter created a whole lot of changes in terms of racial liberalism. And I assume that people we're going to have a second period of that. So that's one thing. And the second part of that, and like Robert Griffin, who does some polling for Democracy Fund, made this point to me. I thought it was a very good point, is that once people start expressing certain attitudes and behaviors, they want their political views and their actions to line up with that. So if more and more people are saying, I care about racial inequality, anti-Black racism is a huge problem, I believe in integration, I think you're going to have more people start saying that over time, and then they're going to have to sort of line up their actions to that. And I think you will, and I think you're going to start seeing it. You know, I don't know when schools are going to start meeting again because of COVID, but I do think on the school issue, and I've heard this already, people who have done this reading of these books about race and racial inequality these last few weeks, I've had a lot more conversations personally about school integration with white people than I had previously. I think people are thinking about that, and they're sort of like, okay, now that it's been sort of announced to me that school integration is actually important, how do I actualize that? They're not really sure how, but I think those conversations are happening, and I think in part because once you say that race, you know, once sort of racism and racial inequality are at the top of your mind, I think that you're going to have to line up your actions to that. So I think there is a potential that these polls look differently in a year and more, and their ideas that are more supported than you would have thought.
Yeah, I would co-sign all of that. Once voters determine whether a beneficiary, you know, deserves a policy's effect, you know, in this case, if we're talking about reparations, the decision about whether to support the policy should then become relatively simple. So like Perry says, kind of connecting these ideas about racism and discrimination to policies that would actually change that is, you would think, the logical next step here. And then also Perry mentioned this elite signaling. I think this is also where representation in Congress matters. You know, you have a more racially diverse Congress, largely because of the Democratic Party and the way that they talk about, I mean, the white Democrats as well, it's changing, but the way they talk about race and racism is crystallizing. And then in that sense, it's clearer to their constituents or their supporters how to think about these issues. And I think that contributes to these, or will contribute to, shifting attitudes.
Like, we talked on the podcast on Monday about the idea that Joe Biden had promised to pick a woman as vice president and a Black woman as a Supreme Court justice. I'm not sure that Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton could have done that because of who they are, and it probably helps that Joe Biden's a white man, but I do think that kind of thing might change attitudes. It might be like, oh, well, Joe Biden, who I respect, kind of said, I'm going to consider race and gender in these kinds of things, and he was unabashed about it. So maybe, I mean, some jobs it might be illegal to do that, so don't necessarily do that. I mean, it's not necessarily clear you can do that in every case. But I think the fact that, like, people like Joe Biden are talking about race more openly and talking about how to address it more openly, because I think that kind of signaling really matters. Like, there's a lot of evidence that Black people's views on gay marriage changed once Barack Obama said, I support gay marriage. And so I would think about that in this context. Like, I know the Congress has this, Democrats in the House are thinking, they have this bill to study reparations, and they're nervous about bringing it to the floor, and I think they're right to be nervous about it. But I do think if they actually, you know, call that bill to a vote, and then a reparations study is approved by the majority of the House, which means the most House Democrats voted for it, I think, and Joe Biden, I think, is already for that study. It's not it's just a study, it's not reparations, but I do think that kind of thing will make people think, okay, if the Democratic position is reparations should be thought about, I'm a Democrat, let me make sure, if Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi think it's a good idea, why do I think it's not a good idea? So I think that kind of thing really matters a lot.
One of the common narratives that's developed over the past 5 to 10 years has been that white liberals are becoming very quote-unquote woke, and that they may even becoming more quote-unquote racially liberal than minorities in the Democratic Party. And this study has been cited in various places to back that up. And it's the 2018 American National Election Studies pilot survey. And it found that 78% of white Democrats thought having more races slash ethnicity in the country makes it a better place to live. 57% of Black Democrats felt that way, and 63% of Hispanic Democrats felt that way. And then other data shows that white liberals rate non-white groups more positively than they do whites. And white liberals are the only group that, you know, favor the out-group over their group themselves. So this has gotten plenty of play in certain circles of the internet. Does the data that you uncovered in this piece challenge that? This idea that, you know, white Democrats have become so liberal that they're even more liberal than Black Democrats on these kinds of issues?
Sure. I mean, the short answer is I think yes, but if we think about the groups themselves a little bit more. So white Democrats and white liberals are very different groups, actually. So because, you know, about half of the Democrats are consider themselves moderate or conservative, some number like that. So when you define yourself as a white liberal in this point in the world's history, that means you have fairly liberal views on racial issues, too. So asking someone who defines themselves as being liberal on everything, if they're liberal on racial issues, then yes, they are. It's also worth thinking about when you talk about the category of Black Democrats. Since most Black people do not feel comfortable with the Republican Party, there are plenty of people who call themselves conservative who are Black who are still Democrats. There are plenty of people who are moderate who actually are moderate on issues who are Black who are Democrats. So white liberals is a category of people who have liberal views on everything, versus Black Democrats is a category of people that includes basically all Black people. So I think that's worth thinking about. That said, if you look at the reparations number, I think it does tell you something, is that white liberals may be more, even white, younger white Democrats may be more liberal on racial issues in sort of an expressive way than a here's my money way. So I think that's worth thinking about as well. But I don't discount those stories. I just think it depends on what issue we're talking about. I do think on like Medicare for all, white liberals might be to the left of Black Democrats. I think that's probably true. I don't know if we talk about like school integration that involves busing, I'm not sure that I am sort of too confident that white Democrats and maybe even white liberals are to the left of Black people.
Yeah, I have seen that go around. And there's a new political science paper, I don't have the title in front of me, but it's about this notion of collective guilt, which is defined as white people's remorse for their group's treatment of Blacks and emphasis on their group, the historical nature of their group's treatment of Blacks. And that contributes to, well, they're less prejudiced and they're more likely to support policies that benefit Blacks. And you can believe that slavery affects Black people today and not feel guilt. And you can not be racist and also not feel guilt. So guilt is a unique concept, the authors argue. And it is just, it's a small population of white liberals who possess it, but that it impacts their beliefs about a lot of these things. And I do wonder a little bit about how much that factors into this idea that you favor the out-group, because you may feel shame about your own group's treatment of other racial groups.
One thing I wanted to note was Pew has some polling on reducing police funding that came out recently. And what they found is the group most supportive of that is Black people under 45. The group second most supportive of that is white Democrats under 45. The group that is third most supportive is Black Democrats over 45. And the group that is least supportive is white Democrats over 45. In other words, I do think that some of these racial issues have a age component that is worth thinking about. And I do think that white Democrats under 45 are getting close, and if some issues are more racially liberal than Black Democrats over 45. So in other words, age and race are important interactions here. I do think the younger liberal white cohort is moving left on racial issues in a very aggressive way, and maybe to the left of Black 65-year-olds. I think that's true.
As we wrap up here, we talked a lot about all kinds of different data that I know you have scoured the internet and the archives for. What are the limitations on collecting data that is specifically about the preferences of Black and white Democrats? Understanding that when we talk about crosstabs on this podcast, we're oftentimes talking about Democrats and Republicans, or maybe old people and young people, or men and women. But these are much smaller subsets of the American public. So what are the challenges here? And what have we learned about polling from doing this?
With respect to like specific policy prescriptions, it's really hard to find polls where those are the questions that are asked. You do have to usually look for specialized institutes or think tanks that are interested in those issues in particular. And then with the groups that we're interested in, you need larger sample sizes and those are more expensive. And so that further limits the, you know, where we can look for data on this. And then I'll add one more thing. A lot of the questions, like you mentioned, that we're talking about here are complicated. So the degree to which you can, I'm going to use the word trust, but trust the public opinion polls on issues like these that are very specific is dubious. There was a time when there were these things called deliberative polling, where they would actually, you know, bring people to a certain place all together on a weekend. That would never happen, obviously, right now. But you would bring people together and they would have experts there talking about all the many sides of an issue. And then so they would poll people before the deliberation, and then they would poll people after the deliberation. And then you're arguably getting, you know, more informed opinions. And those are even rarer, but probably a better indicator of what people actually think than, you know, polls that ask a question without knowing necessarily how much the person understands the issue.
And I would say the biggest limitation, and I've sort of been bemoaning this and I'll do it again here, is that the pollsters, I don't know, I don't have the exact racial diversity of the American pollster industry, but I've seen pictures of their conferences, and let's put it that way, and they're not a particularly racially diverse group, and I think that comes out in the questions at the time, which is that we have a ton of pollsters asking about reparations, Confederate monuments, and the police, and not a whole lot of other variety of questions. And I do think if that group was more diversified, you might, it almost seems like they're looking for each other's questions and then sort of repeating them over and over again. I feel like I'm good on these certain questions now. And I think they asked one question I find really problematic. There's been this question asked, how are race relations in America? And I understand why that question is asked. There's a historical record of that question being asked. That said, my guess is that David Duke and Al Sharpton both think race relations in America are bad and can be improved. And so when they both say yes to that answer, that doesn't tell us anything. Basically, are race relations bad is a way of asking, is the news media covering some racial story a lot? And that is obviously yes at times or no at times. But that's not a particularly useful question to ask. The second thing I think is a problem is that because we don't have a lot of polls with large sample sizes of Black Democrats or Black people, and we don't have a lot of polls done by Black people running the polls, asking the questions. So when I talk to Black people about reparations, we usually don't discuss very much, you know, the worthiness of them or what have you. What we usually go to is, can you imagine what the backlash would be if they gave us all a bunch of money? Can you, you know, we might get a president that is, you know, even more racist than some presidents we've had before. So I think that's the conversation is like, not just is this a good idea and this is a fair idea, but how will white people perceive this policy? And so I wish there were a way to have the question sort of embed that or have the discussion kind of embed that, because you're not getting necessarily Black people's views purely on, is this a good idea? They're sort of thinking, is this a good idea in the country that I live in, where when the Black president said we should not arrest a person in front of their house, that was a controversial position. So I think that is like worth thinking about is like, are we asking, maybe we need some focus groups, some better questions, some more targeted questions, because asking reparations in this sort of vague way, I think if you ask Black people, if you ask them, can you get reparations without a huge backlash, the number might be like 80, but people are sort of thinking about the backlash too.
Yeah, these are all really good points, and I hope people learned a good amount about, you know, where the divisions that currently exist fall, and we'll be able to come back to this in the future and see if they persist through this, you know, reckoning that we've been talking about. So thanks a lot for joining me today, Perry and Meredith. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Galen. This is great.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.